This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
November 6th, 2020, the world of hockey lost a great one. A Hall of Fame caliber defenseman whom time has most definitely forgotten. And now, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to visit with his children, Dana, Darcy, and David, and the great captain of the New York Rangers, Vic Hadfield, as we take a look back at the life and career of a great one, Jim Nielsen.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello, and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 96, Jim Nielsen. For those of you who don't know who Jim Nielsen was, well, he was an absolutely terrific defenseman for the New York Rangers during the 1960s and early 1970s. Back on November 6th, 2020, unfortunately, we lost Nielsen. He was also known as the Chief. And today on Sports Forgotten Heroes, I welcome his children, Dana Nielsen, Darcy Wade, and David Nielsen to the podcast to talk about their dad. And also joining is another great from the New York Rangers, Vic Hadfield. Ironically, I was unable to contact Vic for a podcast I did about him a few years back, episode number 25, but he graciously agreed to appear on this episode of SFH to talk about his good friend. Vic was the captain of the Rangers, a 50-goal scorer, and when Nielsen joined the team for the 1962-63 season, a lifelong friendship was formed. A few notes that you need to be aware of for today's episode. Dana, Darcy, and David all live in different areas of Canada, as does Vic. And to get everyone together for this podcast, I recorded the entire episode on Zoom. Now, the cool thing about Zoom is you are able to separate audio channels. For those of you who know what that means, cool. For those of you who don't, no worries. But just know that when I edited this episode, it meant that I was able to isolate who was speaking and turn the audio channel off for those who weren't. So, I was able to limit any unnecessary background noise to a point. That is, with the exception of Darcy and Vic. As it turned out, Vic was unable to connect via Zoom. So, he was on the phone with Darcy, and she kindly placed the phone near her microphone so we could hear Vic. While his audio isn't the clearest, it is still quite understandable, and he had a lot of great commentary to add to SFH regarding Jim's career, the Rangers, the competition and the game, and of course, as you would expect, Jim's children all spoke so very reverently of their father and made a good case for why they think their father deserves to be in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Vic did as well. After listening to today's episode, I invite all of you to go to my website, sportsfh.com. There I have more on Jim and some more notes on why they think Jim should be inducted. Really good stuff. Oh, one other thing, unplanned. I recorded this show on November 28th, 2020, 3 weeks after Jim had passed, and ironically, on what would have been his 80th birthday. So, I feel somewhat grateful that I was able to provide an outlet for Jim's children to speak about their dad on what should have been a terrific day to celebrate. A few other notes before we get into today's show. Sports Forgotten Heroes is a member of the new Sports History Network. You can check it out at sportshistorynetwork.com. It's a place where several of us who have sports history podcasts have come together under one umbrella for great content on the history of sports. It's pretty cool. Of course, I also encourage everyone to check out sportsfh.com. As I just mentioned, I have more information on Jim there, more information on all of the forgotten heroes whom I have featured, information on my guests, an archive of all my shows, and it has a comment section so you can ask questions, make comments, and even suggest forgotten heroes for me to research and to do a podcast about later on. Please follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes. Look for my Sports Forgotten Heroes page on Facebook or follow on Instagram. Lastly, please, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, give Sports Forgotten Heroes a 5-star rating. And as always, thanks for your support. Now, back to today's show and Jim Nielsen. So, who was Jim? Well, he was a stud defenseman, a guy who would stand you up at the blue line, a hard hitter, and a guy, as his daughter Darcy said, was so proud of his defensive skills that he took extra pride in his skills when his teammates Eddie Jacquemin and Gilles Villemure won the Vezina Trophy for the best goalies in the NHL in 1971. He took great pride in his game and just might be one of those guys who, for no real reason, has been overlooked for the game's highest honor, induction into the Hall of Fame. So let's get on with today's show with Dana, Darcy, David, and the great Vic Hadfield. I want to thank you all for being here, for being on Sports Forgotten Heroes. I think the way I would like to start this is with Vic and Jim's career. The two of your careers, they basically paralleled each other, is the way I understand it. You basically played for the Rangers at the same time with Jim joining the team 1 year after you did. So, Vic, on the ice, what were Jim's strengths? What kind of game did he play?
First of all, he was just a great teammate, and he certainly took the instructions well, that was given to him. So you could see that he was a smart player, a big young man, and he could skate. He was a real good skater, and tough. He didn't always play tough. By that, I mean, he never fought and all that stuff, but he was tough to play against. So we knew we had something going pretty good when Jimmy first came with us.
Do you think he got the kind of recognition that he deserved? When I look back at his career, he struck me as someone who was very steady. You knew he'd score about 6 to 8 goals a year, add about 25 assists a season, and he'd get his share of penalties. Not a lot, about 65 minutes or so a year, but he was steady. He was a rock. Did he get the recognition that he deserved?
I think he did. As far as the rest of the players, we certainly appreciated what he was doing. You're totally right. When he was steady, he came to play every night. I moved the puck well, and it was just a great teammate. We had a lot of respect for Jimmy when he first came with us.
Raj Aubert once said that Jim defines defensemen as well as anyone who has ever played our game. What are your recollections of Jim on the ice, and how did he compare to his contemporaries? I'm talking about guys like Brad Park, who I think might have been his defensive partner, Carl Brewer, Jacques Laperriere, Tim Horton. I left out Bobby Orr because I guess that guy's sort of in a class by himself. But how did he compare to his contemporaries?
Well, again, I'll repeat myself to the fact that he was a steady player, and we knew that he was going to be playing every minute of the game. He never took a shortcut. He was very steady, moved the puck. He could play tough in front of the net, because Jimmy was a big boy. And so that's what you're looking for as a teammate. And so we all stuck together, played as a team, and Jimmy was certainly part of that.
Okay, guys, your father had a very unique upbringing, at least from how I read it. Can you talk about it and how unique it is to have been in an orphanage and make it all the way to the NHL? How does that happen?
Who wants to take this? Darcy.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead, Darcy.
Go ahead, Dana. Well, I think... I think, how does it happen? I guess we look back now and it's pretty remarkable. It's certainly not a likely path for anyone to grow up in an orphanage and end up, playing professional hockey. I think Dad would say he just went out and played hockey. I don't think he had this big plan, that he was going to grow up and be in the NHL. I think he just, he just played a lot of hockey and I guess he got noticed in junior hockey. He played, he always talks about, in junior when he played for the Prince Albert Mintos that he was a forward, and I guess there were some injuries and so they put him back on defense. And that was like the turning point for him. I think he found his spot as a defenseman. And then, in those years, they didn't draft players, I think. So the Rangers had the rights to the Prince Albert Mintos, and he got noticed, and I think he just went out and just played hockey. And it's different times, but he always felt like being annoyed, like he just was on the ice all the time. He got encouragement and from the nuns and the orphanage, and he just I don't know. Just Dana and David, you want to step in at all?
Well, just to sort of explain to everyone Dad's background. Of course, he was born in Big River, Saskatchewan, and was in the orphanage from the age of five with both of his sisters. His dad is Danish, or was Danish, and his mother is a Cree Indigenous person from Canada, is the term now. She remained on the Big River First Nation. And I think from a standpoint of both of Dad's parents, they did what they did for the kids so they could have a better life. And the better life at the time was at the orphanage. So you could get educated, you had a roof over your head, you were fed. And with that, from Dad's perspective, the orphanage was also a good place for him. We don't know, and we'll never know, if he had not been in the orphanage, whether he would have been an NHL player, because he was able to start playing hockey and was very much supported by everyone at the orphanage. One sister in particular, Sister Ignatius, we've heard stories that she would take extra sandwiches to Dad because she knew he was playing hockey, which is lovely. And in the summers, we would go back as kids when we would summer in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and we'd visit the sisters, because that was Dad's, as far as we knew, his home, and these are the people who raised him. That's not to include either of his parents, of course.
Well, why was he in an orphanage? What led to him being in an orphanage?
Go ahead, Darcy.
I think his parents separated when, I guess, Dad was really young, and his mother went back. Both of their parents were alive. She went back to the to live in Big River with the First Nations. And then dad's father was a mink rancher. So we're looking like the 1940s in northern Saskatchewan. He just couldn't care for the kids, I think, was really. And he just felt that this was maybe the best choice for the kids, so they could get, you know, like Dana said, go to school, you know, be fed. And so that, you know, that was why I think they would see their dad sometimes in the summer. They would visit, but I think as time went on, maybe less of that happened. But dad never complained. Like he felt like he was treated well. He never felt like it was, he never complained about his upbringing, really. Like he felt it was, you know, he was treated well. And he would, the one thing he would say that stands out in my mind as an adult, and as we learn more about dad, in the last, you know, as we were adults, is that he said they were hungry. And that, you know, that bothered me a lot when the first time he said that. But it wasn't even complaining. He just said sometimes they were hungry. And he'd also said he couldn't believe he still ate potatoes because he ate so many potatoes when he was growing up. And he had to peel the potatoes for all the kids too. Like he had to actually work for his dinner. So, but, you know.
How proud of his heritage was he, Danish and Cree? And I guess I'm really talking more on the Cree side. How proud of his heritage was he?
David, you want to take that? Yeah.
Obviously, I think, like anyone, very, very proud of where you come from and your background and your ancestry, right? Like it just, and not really being very open or talkative or saying a lot about it. Dad just, it was more in his actions and the way he operated and the way he lived. You know, he was just, on the hockey rink and on the ice, he let his play do the talking, right? And the 60s, 70s era, it's a tough era. And Vic can, you know, attest to this. You know, you handle things on the ice the way you needed to handle things, right? And so I think he never got too high, he never got too low on and off the ice about racism and stereotyping and all that kind of stuff. He just did what he had to do to survive, right? And I kind of, to answer your very first question, how does someone get from the orphanage to the NHL? Right now it doesn't happen. That doesn't happen, right? Like it didn't happen 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and it's just a very rare thing, right? So, you know, part of that being true to yourself and where you come from and where you grow up and who you are, you know, is everything that takes you to where you got to, right? So so that's the way I kind of look at it, right? Like, you always more than willing to help out in whatever way was asked to, you know, and for Indigenous communities during his playing hockey career and after, right? And so, but dad's very humble too, right? Like he's not outspoken or brash or anything like that. So he wouldn't be too overt about it. He just knew the impact he made.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Vic, this question is for you. When Jim joined the team, when he joined the Rangers, did he already have the nickname Chief, or was that something that he earned while he was with the team? Where did the nickname Chief come from?
Well, I don't know. Maybe just more guessing where it came from. I mean, we knew that Jimmy was, a Cree. And I guess we felt comfortable enough with Jimmy around that somebody just started calling him Chief, and he answered to it. So he was comfortable. We weren't slamming him or anything. This was a nickname, which a lot of the guys had little nicknames. But Jimmy, it was you know, he was proud of what the heritage is, and that was good enough for us. We just you know, tremendous amount of respect for him, because we did find out, you know, where, you know, he was from the orphanage, and not that. You know, this, I guess being in the orphanage was one that got him started to be able to play. And as the girl said, that he's, and David, that this is where he had the opportunity to be fed, had a roof over his head. And he certainly respected all that that was done for him, and all through his career and his life. I mean, he was always well respected by everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, there was another person with an indigenous background who just passed away too. I don't know if you know of him, Fred. I it's a hard name for me to pronounce.
Sasakamoose.
Did players like Fred and Jim ever face any sort of racism that you know of based on their heritage? I know there were writers who might have used some colorful language to describe Jib and to describe Fred, language and stuff that you would never attempt to get away with today. I don't even know if the nickname Chief could even be used today. Vic, do you know of any sort of racism they faced on the ice during that period?
Can't remember it ever happening, because you know, we as the rest of his teammates would never put up for that. So, but nobody has showed any disrespect to Jimmy, because he is a Cree. So we never ran into anything like that. We stuck together as a team. We played hard off the ice and on the ice. We all gathered around and had dinners and little get-togethers as a team, and Jimmy was right front and center.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Dana, Darcy, David? Did your dad ever talk about anything like that? Did he ever have to face anything on the ice that you're aware of?
I'll just real quick. Every now and then he would say, you know, a little bit about it, right? You know, but that was the game within the game. I'm not sure that he didn't hand it back too, you know, if there's the odd, you know, negative comment or anything like that. I don't think it was a lot, to tell you the truth. I think the respect in the game, and especially in the 50s, 60s and 70s, after a while, when you have a lot of respect, I don't think, and as Vic said, and with compounded with a real tight knit group, it's not going to happen that much, because you know that person can handle it and dish it out, you know, any which way it needs to be dished out, right? And so, yeah, but I would think he never talked too much about it, but knowing what I know about Freddie Sasakamoose and Dad, yeah, they would have experienced it for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in New York. I grew up just outside of New York City in Westchester County. And I used to go down to the city all the time, and it was a pretty intimidating place, especially when I was young. So I don't know if any of you can answer this. Did Jim ever talk about the culture shock of going from an orphanage, a small town, to New York and going to play hockey for the New York Rangers? Did he ever talk about what that experience was like at first? And Vic, maybe you can relate to this the best. I mean, after all, you lived through part of that scenario too.
Well, it's true. And when we first went, I mean, I was 20 years old and I'd never been to New York before. And so we flew down and just amazed at the view of flying in on the plane. And then you kind of, you know, pinch yourself to see if you're still with it, and seeing the amount of people, but everybody never had any problems with any of the crowds. They loved the hockey, But I always do remember walking from the hotel over to the old Madison Square Gardens and just a massive, you know, amount of people all going somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we all fit in, even though, I mean, I was born and raised in Oakville here. We probably had 16,000 people in this little town that I grew up in. And to go down now and see, geez, I'm in New York, and look at the people. And the fans were really good to us, even though we didn't have very good years at the beginning. Mm-hmm. They stuck with us because, as you can see, they were at least trying. We're not going to win all the games, but as long as you're trying, they're going to be on your, you know, on your side. Jimmy fit right in, and the same as all the guys. We made sure everybody was comfortable. Everybody was not slipping away by themselves somewhere. There would always be 5, 6, 7 guys going to have dinner or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever talk to any of you about his initial reactions to playing in such a place?
Well, we all talked about it. You know, geez, you see, somebody would walk down the street that didn't have any clothes on. But, you know, we would look at geez, look at that. Didn't bother anybody else in the city. They just kept going. I remember, this would be a little funny thing. We had a Halloween party at Joe Delamere's house. And he had to dress up, naturally. I went as a ballerina. I had the blonde hair, the big boobs, short dress, size 11 and a half high heels. I walked about 3 blocks.
In the city, we're walking.
In Long Beach.
Oh, in Long Beach, okay. Still.
Look at you. This is okay. I mean, I had to stop and get a pack of cigarettes, and I looked in the mirror and I said, geez, I could take a run at that guy. That's how we are. We stuck together, and I can't stress that enough. And Jimmy was certainly one of us, and at different backgrounds, naturally. But just a lot of respect. I just can't say that enough.
His game really picked up, I think, when you look at the numbers and you go back through his year-by-year stats, his game, I think, really picked up around the 67-68 season, and that's when the Rangers started to turn the corner. It was the first time he ended up the season on the plus side. He was a plus 27. He was an all-star, one of 2 times he made the all-star team, and he finished 4th in the Norris Trophy voting. Can you all talk about the evolution of his game, those few years from 1967 through 1973? He really was a stalwart on the blue line. How did his game evolve?
Well, the thing is that, you know, we started to get a better hockey club together in those days that you gave me. And, but, I mean, he started right from the beginning. We knew he was a tremendous skater. And I think he gained confidence, the same as all the rest of the young guys. We looked, you look down the bench and, we had some pretty good players there.
Sure.
And Jimmy was certainly one of them. And I think he gained more confidence in handling the puck. He knew he was a New York Ranger, very proud. And it developed that way. He was a great teammate to have on your side. That's basically it.
I want to know what it's like growing up with a father who is a star athlete. Were you able to appreciate it when you were younger? Did you know, or was it more like dad's a hockey player and that's just his job? I mean, what is the mentality in your household? He's gone, how many months a year, and then he shows back up. What was it like growing up with a father who's a star player in a professional sport like the National Hockey League?
Well, from my perspective, Warren, I think it was that was his job. And this sort of goes back to your question about from orphanage to New York City. Dad never said much to me at all about, holy smokes, you know, from orphanage to New York City. But he really took so much in stride. And I think what he would also say is he's talked about how he and our mother married, I think, in 1962. And I think that that for him really helped to sort of have that to start him on his path, I guess, in a way, in New York City. And what I remember about New York City is the Ranger family is what I would call it. And that still exists today. I've had text messages from Audrey McGregor today because it's Dad's birthday. So I remember spending time with kids of the other Rangers. Sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional.
That's okay. That's okay. I hear you.
Yeah, we actually, Vic's kids, we all lived really close together in Long Beach. We all went to school, and we all the players in my memory and their families all lived like we lived out in Long Beach and not a big community. I remember the Jockamans lived behind the block behind us. Vic, where were you guys? We were on Trenton Avenue. I forget. You guys were close, so I know I'm probably walking distance.
Well, you should, because you're always over at my place eating.
Oh, yeah. So I've known Vic's kids like my whole life, basically, and Dane and David too, and Rattel's kids. Like we all, so it was definitely a Ranger family for sure. That we, you know, everyone was really close knit, like the players and the I think all the wives hang out, the kids hung out. We went to practices. I remember when the team, I guess when we could, we would go to Saturday morning practices, and that was really fun. But Dana, I think what Dana said about, you know, your dad being a hockey player, that it was his job. I mean, I think we thought it was kind of cool because we could go to the hockey games and we could go to practice and stuff, but it was just, it wasn't, you know, Dad was very humble, and we didn't like, it wasn't a big deal, I guess. But, you know, I guess looking back at it now, you know, you're like, wow, that was pretty cool. So, but yeah. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah.
I think, too, that some of the stuff in small town Saskatchewan that happened in the off season, you know, I have people that I hang out with and know to this day that would come up to me and say, yeah, I knocked on your door, get your dad's autograph in the summer. And, you know, this is in the summer, just people doing random things like that. And I don't remember it. I was probably too young about to remember that. Maybe Dana and Darcy did, but it was just those kind of things would happen. And we never just took it in stride, and it was pretty cool, and never really, you know, I remember I used to have, when Dad played with Gretzky at the end of his career, we used to have all the sticks from the Oilers, including a lot of Gretzky sticks, right? But I would use them for road hockey and ruin them, yeah. Right? I could have been sitting on a pile of money right now, but you never really thought of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Warren, the reason we never thought of it also was we're a bit like our father that way. He was always very unassuming and humble, and I think we all took our cues from him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting. What was your dad like at home? Was he was he quiet? Did he tell dad jokes like my kids tell me, oh, Dad, that's another terrible dad joke you're telling. You're annoying me. Was he serious? Was he a practical joker? What was he like?
Hi, Scarlett.
A little bit of all of that. He was a typical dad, and he would have, Dad's a quiet guy in general, but he was very, he was funny. I think, you know, a lot of the things that we've been hearing from all over, he had a really good sense of humor. So he would joke around. The stories he would talk about would be, you know, like funny stories that he'd be talking about, things that, you know, happened at the rink or whatever, but it'd always be about jokes and stuff like that. Those would be the things that he'd, so he'd be laughing and telling us stuff like that. And, but yeah, like he'd tell the dad jokes, but we, you know, he was just a, you know, he was there for you. He was always there. And, you know, it was different. The travel schedule, I guess, in the winter, they would, you know, the players would be gone for a while. Dad wouldn't be home for a bit, but he'd come home. But when he was home, right? Because of the type of job you have, he wasn't 9 to 5. So, you know, he taught us a lot. He taught us, you know, and
I think some of the stories were really, you know, hard to imagine. And, you know, with all the stuff that would happen with, you know, people coming to your house, just randoms and asking for autographs. And then he'd tell these long stories, at least to me. I don't know if he told them to Dana and Darcy about, you know, practical jokes that I wouldn't be not sure if they were real or not real.
That's until, true.
You know,
yeah.
Finally a little bit older, right? Like you never really end the story. Like it was just like, the time he told me that he got his slap shot was too hard for the NHL and they banned it because he took one and it went through the net at Madison Square Garden and through the boards and hit an old lady in the knee. So NHL couldn't have that. And they just said, you know, you just passing only now. And that's just one of them, right? And though, and you're young and impressionable. And then you see all these other stuff happening and like, well, could it be true?
Well, you know? He did that a lot with David. David's 5 years younger. So a lot of it, we were pretty sure, David, that it wasn't true. But we enjoyed him telling you these stories.
What was it like to go to the Garden to watch Vic play, to watch Jean Rattel play, to watch Raj Aubert, to watch your father, to know that your father is down on the ice with the greatest players in the game, and he was one of them. What was that like?
Well,
I don't remember, you know, I wasn't born.
Yeah, David was pretty young when we lived in New York. I'm the oldest, so I was, you know, when I got to be like 8, 9, 10, I think I was able to go to games. Like I couldn't go on a school night, but, you know, on the Rangers, I used to have Sunday afternoon games. And I think that's when we were allowed to go. And it was good. It was, you know, it was, I don't know. I think it was back to, that was Dad's job. It was like, kind of like, you know, we just kind of went because, you know, to watch him play. And but what I do remember sometimes is in the warm up, I would go down closer to ice level, and I know Dad could see me, and so we'd be watching, and he would shoot the puck at the glass where I was standing to kind of, so like he, as a joke, like he would be laughing. And
what I remember is it was very important. Did go to a game. It was a very big deal when we were younger kids, and we would have to be dressed up because it was almost like going to church. And I remember my mom, of course, with the other wives, always getting ready for a game. And, you know, it was, you know, the respect you would show because your dad was a professional hockey player, and the importance of that, I remember. New York, I don't have a great memory of. I do have a memory of later years, and certainly playing in Edmonton and going to the games there was wonderful because you got to know more about hockey and paid more attention to the game.
Yeah, yeah. When we were older, I think we got to go to all the games, I think, yeah, in like Edmonton and stuff, yeah, and maybe Cleveland, yeah.
Old Cleveland, the old Cleveland Barons.
Yeah.
Must have been a very unique experience going from Madison Square Garden, I guess, to the Richfield Coliseum, the the size of the crowds must have been a quite the difference.
Very much so.
Yeah. I'd love an answer to this question from two different perspectives. And Vic, you have your perspective, and Dana, Darcy, and David, I'm sure you have a perspective on this as well. When a season is over and the player arrives home from the two different perspective, what is it like for dad to come home? Is dad relaxed, or does it take him some time to wind down? And from the player's perspective, Vic, when the season does come to an end and you do go home, is there an adjustment period? How long does it take to readjust to being at home and not going to the rink?
Well, in the 60s, that's what we played, Skip started, Jimmy included. It was, we didn't have a very good team. And so we always used to fight for fifth and sixth place on the 16th league. And, you're disappointed at the end of the year. You're leaving your teammates. And, in the 60s, we all didn't make a tremendous amount of money. We all had to go home and work. I remember getting beat out our last game, say, on a Sunday. We'd pack up the kids on Monday, and then drive home. I'd start work on Wednesday. And that's how I, got started in the golf business at that age. But we all, respected the opportunity to play. I remember the first contract I signed, and it was $7,500.
Wow.
But I bought a Pontiac Strato Cheese, $600. Rent, as we were talking, we all lived on the Long Island.
Yeah.
We rented a three-bedroom, furnished, completely furnished, all utilities, for $115 a month, and you're a block off the ocean.
Yeah. Wow.
That's something.
You go home and you save money.
Yeah. Yeah.
I look forward to it. This is something that I've chosen, the same, Jimmy would say the same thing. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to play. I'm going to be, playing the National Hockey League. But back then, too, if you were 30 years old, and here's Jimmy and I were in the year 19 and 20, by the time you're 30 years old, you better be ready to do something else. Because that's, at the age where you're not going to be able to play anymore. Start thinking, oh, 30, I'm 20 now. It sure got you ready for the next year. And, because you were embarrassed because you never made the playoffs. And then, 64, 65, we started to put a pretty good hockey club together. And winning, I guess, drove us to do the best you possibly can. Again, stand together as a team. In the summertime, we were always in touch with everybody. Do that today. There's about 8 or 10 guys I'm constantly involved with, families and situations. And you never forget those times.
Sure, sure. Darcy, I guess you might have maybe the best recollection. From what I'm gathering, you might be the oldest. What was it like when dad would come home after the season was over? Was there an adjustment period? And what did he do during the off season?
Well, I think probably till maybe, say the late 60s, 1970, he was like, Vic, he had to go home and get a summer job. So I think he worked at a sod farm. He worked at a few different jobs in the summer. So he did that initially. And then, I think dad, he enjoyed the summer too. We dad was grew up in Saskatchewan. So we had a family summer home in Prince Albert where he was from. And it's a beautiful, I know most people would be surprised to hear that, but it is really nice there. The summers are great there. Lots of lakes. Dad would play golf and he loved fishing. So he, you know, and he had, you know, lots of friends there. So I think he, when the Rangers started to do better and you know, have a long playoff run, he certainly, obviously that was something that, you know, they wanted to keep going as long as possible. But I think when the season was done, and, you know, it was, you know, his time in the summers and time off where he could, you know, go back to Saskatchewan and do some other, you know, and play golf and enjoy his friends up in Saskatchewan. And we all enjoyed it as kids too. We like going kind of back and forth and doing that. But I don't remember it being a big adjustment. I do remember, I think Vic Crook, I might get the years wrong, 71 maybe, when the Rangers went to the finals. I remember that being a disappointment for sure, that, you know, that they, I don't think they didn't win the cup that year. And I do remember disappointment there for sure, but they, it wasn't a big adjustment. I don't think really, like, it was, yeah. Like, dad was like everything in stride, right? Like, it was just, you know, he was pretty even keeled all along. Yeah,
he seems like he was a very easygoing person in the interviews that I watched of him during my research period for this podcast. And in fact, during my research period for this podcast, Vic, this is a tough one. I saw a tweet where over 500 Ranger fans responded. It was a poll asking, do you know who Jim Nielsen was? 60% said no. So is it possible that the Rangers are somewhat to blame for Jim's lack of notoriety? And is there anything the team can do to help bring his name back into prominence, to help in the mission to get Jim more recognition and maybe even possibly inducted into the Hall of Fame?
I think the Rangers have done a tremendous amount of service to the alumni. They make sure that the guys are looked after. I agree with you on the Hall of Fame subject with Jimmy. He certainly has the record to be there, and hopefully one day they will place him in there. But if you're not, like now, I don't go back to New York, so if you're not there, nobody's going to be there with reporting that you're there and going to the games and all that stuff. There's only two or three guys that live in New York all these years, the plan. So it's, as far as the team doing anything more, I don't think we could really, you couldn't ask for anything better than what they have done. Like I say, that they make sure that everybody's looked after. If you want to do, be down there in the summertime, they would certainly look after you, get you a hotel, get theater tickets, whatever you wanted. They were there to help especially with Neil Francis, Glenn Sather, and now, John Davidson. They're all the same. They look after the players.
I think that there are several people, of course, everybody on this Zoom call included, who think that Jim is deserving of an induction into the Hockey Hall of Fame. What do you think is keeping him out?
It's It's a difficult question, Warren, and I think part of the reason it's difficult is you don't know what happens. You don't know who is even selected to be put forth as a candidate, because it's only members of the Hall of Fame committee who can do that. So you may know the three of us have put together packages for 3 years now, but doing that, it's a public submission. So from there, we don't know if Dad's name is then put forth by any of the members of the selection committee. So that's challenging, a challenging question to answer. Sometimes you think, is it because he played so long ago? That may be, but for us, we've always been guided by a family friend who said, we should honor people when you still can. So the length of time doesn't matter to us, but I don't know the reason why that hasn't happened. It should be difficult to get into the Hall of Fame. Absolutely, we know that. It's an elite category of player. We certainly think our dad is there.
The thing is, too, you know, when we played in the, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, especially when there was, you know, just six teams. Mm-hmm. And then now today we have 30, and we have a lot of European players. So if you're not in the hall, say, 5 years after you've retired, the chances make it more difficult because of the number of players. I mean, there's thousands of players now. And then there's a lot of players, and I know we've talked about this before in, you know, in private conversations type, where there's a lot of players that should be there. They've been on Stanley Cup. Yeah. Bobby Nevin, we just lost him. Mm-hmm. He won two Stanley Cups, mm-hmm. and they've ignored Bobby. And there's, you go down through the list and you have, geez, how come that guy's not in the Hall of Fame? It seems to slip by. I mean, the selection committee seems to be that they change it almost every year. Not totally, but there's three or four new people in there. They've probably never even seen Jim play.
That's
true. Your name's not up front and center in the newspaper, and just seem to ignore you at the point. But I wouldn't really put a lot of thought into it, because we as players knew what Jimmy was capable of doing. I was never on a Stanley Cup winning team, and neither was Jim. But it didn't stop me from doing what I do. I love doing charity work. I love the opportunity to call the different players up, you know, how are they health-wise. I mean, what is it, 30 teams now where they got 20 guys on each team? That's a lot of players.
Yeah.
Over, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. That amounts to do the math. But he's an all-star in my mind, my thoughts. It's a privilege to have the opportunity to know Jimmy as a person and to be a teammate. And good enough for me.
And for a little while, you were his opponent. After the 73-74 season, both of you saw your days with the Rangers come to an end. You went on to play, I believe it was for the Penguins, and Jim went out west to play for the California Golden Seals. As an opponent, what do you recall about his game? How tough was he? How tough was it to play against Jim?
Well, I mean, we knew how tough he was. I mean, he was too much fun to, you know, to practice even. He was always there. He was difficult. I used to tease him all the time.
No. That surprises me, Vic.
Telling him that, you know, Jimmy, you're looking at my number all the time because he's chasing me. That's where I had him. a big smile on his face, and I end up tripping him or do something, and I'm going to get him. And the guy he was, and he'll always be remembered as just a great person.
Did your dad ever talk about those days when he left the Rangers and went on to play for California and then later Cleveland? You know, the differences between playing in New York and playing, you know, I guess it was Oakland and then Cleveland. Did he ever talk about that and how the game changed for him?
I think the only thing I recall that changed for him was the injury he had when he played with the California Golden Seals. And it changed in terms of his skating ability from what I understand. But California, he was certainly a veteran presence there. We loved California. We loved living in California. And it was just a different team. So I remember Al McAdam, they lived down the street from us. So younger players for sure, but we're still in touch with McAdams. They're in Prince Edward Island. So it was a different team unit, not quite the length of the Ranger nucleus, but we loved living there, and we lived beside some wonderful people in the non-hockey world. I think it was a different team, and they weren't quite as good as the Rangers, and there weren't that many fans. But if you go online, I think there's still a California Golden Seals fan club.
There is.
I believe it. They had for as short of an existence as they had, they certainly had a heck of a following. And by the way, when your dad went there, he went there with a great deal of respect. If I recall, he was actually the captain of the team.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think he understood what his role was with the, with such a young team. You know, he was the veteran he kind of, led by example. But yeah, he was the captain there. Yeah. So
he was the captain there because of his age too.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was,
that's true. Yeah.
Had the experience and, he knew, what it took. But again, you're going to California, that's not Long Beach, Long Island.
No.
Two or three blocks of each other. Out there, I think the guys were all over the place. So you're not going to get guys together and the family as much as we had there in New York. It's a unique opportunity living there and having the connection with the family. That was very important.
Difficult was it to leave there and go to Cleveland? And I don't recall, Vic, if you ever got a chance to play in Cleveland against the Barons, but I'm sure it was certainly a unique experience. What was it like to leave California and head to Cleveland and play there?
I still don't remember.
Well, that's when your love of NHL goalies started, though. You don't remember. You'd go to games, and David would know if a goalie had changed his tape from one game to the next.
I was fascinated by the masks back in the 70s. I remember that. Like the goalie in Cleveland, Gary Smith or something like that. He was nicknamed the Cobra. And so he had a really cool mask, and that was part of my attraction to, obviously hockey and goalies and just whatever. It was my initial reaction to it. And then Cleveland, I didn't know any different. It was just going to the game, watching them when we could, when I could, which was probably not very often. But, the odd time I was allowed to go to the game, practice on the weekends, and then skate, right? Or get on the ice before or after practice, right? That was the treat.
Yeah, but you also had white skates on when you were going to skate.
What did he say?
He said he had white skates.
Yeah.
Well, and it was the same franchise. The California moved to Cleveland, and I think it was George Gund who owned the team.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it was the same franchise. You're just going to a different location. So back then, you know, we weren't thinking, I don't want to leave California because it's so beautiful. It was just part of, here's where we're going to be next season. And we also, I have very fond memories of living in Cleveland. And again, at that time, remembering a bit more about going to the games. And I remember, you know, before a game, it must have been after Bobby Orr retired, I saw Mom talking to him, and they were just sitting in the stands, and I walked over and Mom said, well, this is Mr. Orr. And when I look back now, I'm thinking, I met him. If I met him now, I'd be like, wow, you know, you're Bobby Orr. But at the time, it's like, oh, nice to meet you, Mr. Orr. Mom, can I go, you know, get this or that? So it, I think what we're sort of saying, Warren, is it was a different league at the time. And wherever we were, we felt part of the team family. And that's probably what we remember more than the hockey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If any of you had the opportunity to sit in front of the people who vote for the Hockey Hall of Fame, what would you say to them as far as why your dad, Jim Nielsen, or your friend, Vic, Jim Nielsen, deserves to be enshrined?
Well, you're not going to have that opportunity to sit there in front of the selection committee. So, you know, you can forget about that. And I don't know how you would go about it now. I mean, I know the girls, and David was part of that too, reached out to the Hall of Fame. Now, there's no reason why he shouldn't be in there, that's for sure. I mean, his record speaks for itself, not just as a hockey player, but as a person too. Those are the kind of people you want to see at the Hall of Fame. Hopefully, give somebody's head a shake and find out why it, my dad there. It's all up to, and I don't know, I shouldn't say it, but I think it's these people that are on that, I'm sure there's some qualified people, but I don't think they're all hockey experts and, young enough to remember Jimmy. So it's a hard thing to do, and I think the girls did, David too, when they did reach out to the Hockey Hall of Fame, but they haven't done anything. It was what, now 3-4 years?
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah,
3 years.
Yeah.
So you wonder where they're, what they're thinking about. And like I say, there's so many. Nothing against the ladies, but there's now ladies in the the Hall of Fame. A lot of Europeans that are back home and in the UK somewhere.
Yeah.
But around here.
I think the process is a little bit political as well. And but our whole basis on this is not only his hockey career and his comparables, like Rod Langway, he's in there, right? And that was a basis as our comparisons. Dad's stats are right there, maybe even better based on his longevity. What holds him back a little bit is not having a Stanley Cup. And being that defensive defenseman, you look at this process now, as Vic said, it's like 5-6 years out of the NHL, it gets harder. And you're looking at those high flyers, those offensive things, that stuff, you really got to be looking at the fundamentals of the game, the whole game, when you look at Dad's career and the way he played the game. But then on top of it is, your original question right off the bat, who comes from an orphanage and doesn't play minor hockey and then winds up being a runner-up to Bobby Orr I don't know, like 8 years after being out of an orphanage. That's the, you know, the things that we're kind of, you know, maybe you should look a little bit like at that, right? Look at some of the impact and the influence and, I don't know. I heard Don Cherry talk about dad and doing a podcast and, you know, after he passed and talking about his career and in this day and age, the way he played, the way he skated and smart and be able to handle himself, you know, he's an $8 million man in this game, this right now. Right. So, I know he can't look at it that way. Right. But, as far as Hall of Fame is concerned, but you know, those are the things that we're basing this submission on. Right. And we'll see.
Well, and I guess what David speaks very well in terms of where we're coming from, but judging from the last 3 weeks and the people who have reached out to us, contacted us, sent us information about Dad, the fan mail that Dad received decades after he played, it's unbelievable to us and quite overwhelming to see people that do remember him years after the fact, whether it be journalists from New York who've reached out. We had a fellow who contacted me after he heard we were trying to get Dad inducted. And 24 hours later, I had a letter from him. He had season tickets with the Rangers. He said after Dad was traded, he canceled his season tickets.
Wow.
But he gets in touch with me from time to time. He wrote a wonderful letter for us, you know, unsolicited. And that's just one of many, Warren. So if, you know, since Dad's passing, it's we thank each and every person who's reached out to us, whether it's a professional athlete, someone who played with Dad, someone who watched Dad, or someone who has heard about his story and written to him. Thank you.
Yeah, it's meant a lot to all of to us very much. We've been kind of overwhelmed with all the response, and it's just the impact we feel, you know, Dad made, you know, from near and far. And it's not just his hockey career. I think just, you know, his life story is, you know, it's, you know, we've heard that he's inspired people, you know, and we've read some beautiful letters and it's just, it's been wonderful for us. It's really warmed our hearts for sure. So, yeah.
But I don't think there's a single person in the Hall of Fame who you can compare to Dad in terms of where he came from, to touch on what David said.
Well, when we sum it all up, how should your father, Jim Nielsen, be remembered? What is his legacy as far as being a hockey player is concerned?
As a hockey player, you know, I think what you kind of heard from Vic here, you know what I mean? In summary, you know, one of those ultimate teammates, right? He played with them in you know, the good old years, right? And when they came in struggling and then the team slowly got better and playing better. And, you know, so that ultimate, you know, that teammate thing there, you know, like, and, you know, when you get down to the, you know, fundamentals of the way he played, you know, like, you know, it's his, kind of like the way he operated in life. He was never assuming, but effective, right? You know, that very steady, reliable defenseman that could probably, you know, I don't think it's out of line to say he could play in any era. Mm-hmm. And not every hockey player can say that, right? You know, when you look the way, you know, they played, Dad played, it, there's a spot for him on any team in any era. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, not overly flashy at all, but very effective. Right. And so, and, you know, played the right way, you know, on the ice and off the ice. You know, he's around these parts that people really knew him as very humble, very unassuming, and, you know, didn't really, it was more a team thing versus an individual thing, right? Mm-hmm. With that.
I think, and this would be Dad's words, that he, you know, like the year that the Ranger goalies, Eddie Jockman and Jill Villemure won the Vezina, as the two of them won it together. Like, that would be one of the highlights of his career as a defenseman, to, that he, you know, that his goalies, like, won the Vezina. Like, that was, you know, such, you know, like, he's so proud of that. And so he, yeah, I think he, you know, I think he just, you know, he went out and did his job. I saw a quote. It was actually Jill Villemure, and said that Jimmy Nielsen was a goaltender's best friend. Well, that's, you know, like, he was effective, and he was steady and reliable, and just, I think, someone that, you know, his teammates, you know, really counted on day in and day out to do his job well.
Yeah. And we as players on the same team as Jimmy's, as I indicated earlier, that we all had a tremendous amount of respect for Jimmy, the way he played, the way he carried himself off the ice, and good with the fans and the kids. So we knew what type of a person, you know, what Jimmy was. And again, his record speaks for itself. And it's, you know, we're going to have to get lucky here, I guess, and to get him into the hall. And I don't have any other ideas on how you go about it. But, you know, the kids have done so far, and, you know, you would think they would recognize the fact. Look up his record and look what he was all about. And but again, there's so many players out there. You know, back in the 60s when we played, when Jimmy first came up, there was only six teams. Mm-hmm. And each team carried five defensemen. So there you're looking at 30 defensemen that are playing in the National Hockey League. Just 30 defensemen. Today, they, you know, they carry five, six defensemen on 30 teams. It's going to be, you know, very difficult to get in unless you're an outstanding offensive player. You know, it's going to be harder as they go along. So we just have to get lucky.
I think the common theme we've been hearing, and what Vic just mentioned, Warren, was he was respected by all on the ice, whether you played with him or played against him. I got an email the other day from, I don't know how many players were included on it over many decades, to reach out to our family to say how sorry they were to hear of Dad's passing, but they wanted it known how much Dad was respected. Unbelievable. So respected on and off the ice would be what I say my dad's legacy is, not just by hockey people.
Well, that's awesome.
Bobby Hall, yeah,
go ahead.
The other day. Bobby.
Bobby Hall, yeah.
A little emotional there. Mm. You know, just he'd heard about Jimmy's passing. And, you know, what a guy. What a tough to play against. So here's a, you know, a guy like Bobby Hall. I haven't spoken to Bobby in probably 10 years.
Mm.
All to find out about Jimmy.
Well, that's awesome to be respected the way he was, the way he is, to hear from fans, players, executives. Obviously, your dad, Vic, your teammate, was one of the great ones. And who knows, maybe one day they'll take a look back at his career and look at it differently and say he is deserving of being enshrined in the Hockey Hall of Fame. What a great career. And I want to thank all of you, Vic Hadfield, Darcy, Dana, David, thank you so much for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes. It's been a wonderful conversation. As a Rangers fan, I feel very honored and privileged to have had this time with you all. And gosh, I hope you enjoyed it. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Warren. We really appreciate you reaching out to us and talking with us. It means a lot.
So here we are once again, talking about a forgotten star who many think is deserving of induction into his respective Hall of Fame. If you have listened to Sports Forgotten Heroes over the years, when I come across a player who many think is deserving of such an honor, I always say, I'm just telling the story and I don't really get into a debate on whether or not that player is deserving of such an honor. Well, I'm going to make an exception. When you consider all Jim Nielsen did to excel like he did despite the unusual way in which he was brought up, his background, the style of game he played, how difficult it was to get around him, the fact that the middle 6 years of his career, he was a plus 150. He helped Eddie Jacquemin and Gilles Villemure win the Vezina. He was a leader on a team that took the Bobby Orr-led Boston Bruins to six games in the 1972 Stanley Cup Finals. He was a huge part of the resurrection of the New York Rangers from doormat to Stanley Cup contender. There's so much. Yeah, he didn't score a lot of goals, but that wasn't his style of play. He was a stay-at-home defenseman who defined his position better than most and took care of the defensive zone. No, he wasn't flashy. No, he didn't score like Orr, Park, Coffey, and the high-scoring defensemen of the 80s and 90s. Should that preclude him from being enshrined? Heck no. There are so many players in all sports who didn't have the flashy numbers, yet they were inducted into the Hall. I think it's about time that Jim Nielsen be inducted as well. For more on his accomplishments, go to my website, sportsfh.com. Again, that's sportsfh.com. I want to thank all of you for listening to today's podcast. Today's date is December 29th, 2020. So with that in mind, I hope all of you had a great holiday season. And I wish everyone a happy new year. And I sure hope it's better than what we have all just gone through. Here's to a great 2021, and I'll see you next year on Sports Forgotten Heroes.